You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 64, Leviticus 1. I'm your layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing this week?
Very good, Trey. Good to be back.
Yeah, good. Well, I'm excited to get started with this. I got my knife sharpened, my burning.
I've gotten emails that ask me if I was kidding.
What, about doing the show?
Right. No, about doing Leviticus. So, you know, just... I guess for some, it's going to be a tough pill to swallow, but oh well. My goal, you know, in doing Leviticus, I'm not going to go through every verse and talk about where they sliced and diced this or that. My goal in doing Leviticus is, hey, who does Leviticus? For one thing, so it deserves some attention. And secondly, is that there are things in here that I want to touch on that will just sort of help us kind of, you know, have the Israelite in our head. How did they think about what they were doing? How did they think about what was happening? How they were engaging God? Again, some of the bigger picture concepts we talked about in the introduction, you know, ideas of sacred space, the presence of God. And when we get into the sacrificial system, what did the sacrifices mean or not mean? Why are they talked about the way they're talked about? That sort of thing. So we're not going to do nitty gritty verse by verse kind of thing. Just like with Acts, I'm going to go through and pick out things that are worth mentioning that, again, will help give us some insight and make the book more readable, frankly. So in terms of getting started here, I want to go through some preliminaries again before we jump into the first verse. And this will sort of be, again, preparatory. Now, there are, as you can imagine, a number of theories about sacrifice that scholars have come up with. And a lot of these things, I'm just going to go through them real briefly. They're going to sound familiar because they're kind of self-evident if you've ever read through Leviticus or any other sacrificial material in the Old Testament. Chances are these things will have occurred to you. And all of these different approaches, I say theories of offering and sacrifice, but really they're just approaches. All these approaches capture some aspect of what's going on in the sacrificial system, but they're not comprehensive. In other words, they all have something good to say, something good to contribute in the way we think about sacrifice. So the first one, for example, is something that scholars call gift theory. That is, Old Testament offerings seem to be gifts to the Lord. Now, that might sound self-evident, but, you know, since there are other views, other ways to look at sacrifice, this is just one of several. This revolves around the notion that, hey, it sounds like when I read the sacrificial material, that people are bringing sacrificial gifts to the Lord, and they're made up of food items, and it looks like they're sort of presented as food for God. So, like, what's up with that? Well, scholars like Dick Averbeck, who I will quote and allude to several times today and in other episodes, I'm sure, since his focus is ritual, have pointed out that in the ancient Near East, food offerings, again, are at least sometimes conceived of as actually providing sustenance for the gods. Now, the question is, well, is that how the biblical writer is thinking about things? In Mesopotamian texts and rituals, you know, there's this sort of care and feeding of the gods that goes on. And that a lot of that language, you know, does get drawn over into the Old Testament. But again, is that the way we should, you know, be looking at some of these things? It's sort of a yes and no. It's true. Again, Israelites didn't have statues of God that they would lay offerings at or pour, you know, some libation at the feet or something like that. But you still have this language about the Lord's table and the Lord's food, that sort of thing. So there's a little bit of this idea going on, but not quite, and certainly not in several specifics, not what's going on in quote unquote pagan religion. The God of Israel, according to the Old Testament, didn't need to eat. If you go to Psalm 50, for example, you would read, you know, where God says, "If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world and its fullness are mine. Do I eat the flesh of bulls or drink the blood of goats?" Again, the rhetorical question is, well, that's kind of silly. And God says, "Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving. Perform your vows to the Most High." You know, again, the psalmist chimes in there. So that's an example where the psalmist specifically says, look, there's no actual consumption going on here like, you know, some of our neighbors might think. But nevertheless, offerings are referred to as the Lord's food in certain passages, Leviticus 3:11, 3:16. Throughout the book of Leviticus, you're going to get this language here and there. You're going to get the idea that burning the offering, quote, produces an aroma pleasing to the Lord. So you're going to get, you know, some sort of anthropomorphic language. But elsewhere in the Old Testament, you're going to get the denial that there's actually anything sort of literal, you know, going on here as far as consumption. So yeah, no, gift theory, sort of, kind of, sort of, a little bit of this, but not so much of that is sort of the feel that you get. Another example would be the bread of the presence. This people might find interesting, and we'll hit this later on in Leviticus a little bit, but for the most part, this is something we'd get if we were going through Exodus talking about the tabernacle. The whole bread of the presence idea, where the bread is continually placed on the gold table inside the holy place every Sabbath, and there's always a light on, you know, there's this continually burning light in the holy place according to Exodus 27. This is really Exodus 25 through 27, and the incense is always, you know, being burned. Well, all of that was to create the impression that God was home, okay, that the divine presence was always present inside the holy place, as though, you know, God were physically living there. Again, people knew that that wasn't the case. I mean, yes, God does get embodied in the angel who's leading them and so on and so forth, but it's not like you could peek into the window of the tabernacle, so to speak, you know, from a distance, a safe distance, and see God walking around in there like he's home. You know, he's not kicking up and doing something or having a snack. I mean, but nevertheless, you have these trappings that are associated with the tabernacle to, again, convey the idea that the presence of God is here in our camp. It's really here. He's really here. And you don't need embodiment for that, but you do need some sort of visual way to communicate the idea, and this is what's going on. And so when they present offerings, yeah, they're gifts, and you know they are spoken of as food offerings and whatnot. But the Israelites know very well that we don't have an embodied deity in there munching on something after a sacrifice. So it's we can't overly literalize this. Another approach, another theory is communion theory. This is the idea where the point of the sacrificial system is communion with the Lord. Now, in some sacrifices, that very explicitly is the point of the sacrifice. But other sacrifices, it's not really the point. So communion theory, again, you know, presence theory, whatever you want to call that, it's true. You know, they're to some degree it's true, but it's not something that can really comprehensively explain or illuminate it, you know, what the sacrificial system was all about. It's part of a whole, and we could just leave it at that. Another approach is consecration theory. In some Old Testament passages, it seems the primary reason for bringing an offering was to consecrate someone or something to the Lord, you know, to sanctify it, to give it sacred status, to make it holy, to take it out of sort of the common realm and put it into the sacred realm. Leviticus 10:10 says you must distinguish between the holy and the common. That idea. Again, sometimes in ritual texts, sacrificial procedures, that will be sort of evident. For instance, in Exodus 24, the blood is splashed on the altar and on the people. And specifically with the splashing of the blood on the people is to consecrate them, to dedicate them to a relationship with Yahweh. Again, we get that. Leviticus 8 happens to the priests where they put blood on the right ear, the thumb, and the big toe of Aaron and his sons, and so on and so forth. So yeah, sometimes sacrifice is about consecrating a person or an object. Very true, but it doesn't comprehensively explain everything. Now, those are the three major approaches, and I bring them up because you should know that the sacrificial system means all of these things or includes all of these ideas. And at any given point, any one of them could be in play. And it just helps to sort of know that, to kind of think about what's happening. And again, to try to think about what they are thinking about when they're doing a particular act. And we'll hit on all these things as we proceed. So let's jump into Leviticus 1. Not going to read the whole chapter, even though it's short. But let's just take a few verses here. The Lord called Moses and spoke to him from the tent of meeting, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of livestock from the herd or from the flock." Well, I'll just stop there. That's the first two verses. I ought to say something about the offering language that we get in our English translations. Now, in Hebrew, it would be more accurate to translate this to present an offering, bring an offering, present an offering. It's as opposed to a sacrifice. Let's put it that way. Sacrifices and offerings are not necessarily the same thing, even though in modern parlance, the way scholars talk about this, and frankly, the way I talk about it, the terms are often mixed. Technically, an offering was sort of a gift, and sacrificial language is going to be reserved in the Hebrew text to when an animal is slaughtered and then at least part of it is eaten in a communal meal. So sacrifices and offerings aren't necessarily the same thing, even though an offering might involve a sacrifice. But the biblical text, when it uses the language of sacrifice, has a meal in mind. And that's going to become evident as we proceed in some of these chapters. So you might, in your English translations, some of you might see offering there. Some of you might see the word sacrifice. And you might know that there might be a difference here. Why is there a difference? You might ask the question, well, technically there is. Again, strictly speaking, from an Old Testament point of view, the Old Testament limits sacrifice language to animal offerings, animals that are part of the ritual, and even more specific than that, to instances where the animal is slaughtered and becomes part of a meal. But the offerings are much wider than animals. For instance, there's the grain offering, there are bloodless offerings and whatnot. So you might be wondering, well, what do the terms mean something? Can they be distinguished? Yeah, technically, yeah, but typically the way it gets talked about, people don't care, really that much about being terribly precise. We'll be precise when we need to be as we go through. So back to chapter 1, let's go to verse 3. If his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer a male without blemish. He shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting that he may be accepted before the Lord. This, in a nutshell, tells you what the whole burnt offering is about. So if his offering, let's just go through the verse. The word there is korban. It's the noun form of karav, which is the verb form that is to present an offering. So again, this is some sort of gift idea. Turns out to be an animal. It's a burnt offering from the herd. He shall offer a male without blemish. He shall bring it to the entrance of the tent of meeting. You say, well, why is that important? The offerer is allowed, or at least is hoping to be accepted, onto sacred space. So here I am. I'm Joe Israelite. I want to offer a burnt offering. We haven't talked about the specific purpose yet. And I'm bringing my male without blemish from the herd to the entrance of the tent of meeting. And so I'm standing on sacred territory. I mean, this isn't, I can't go any further. I'm right on the cusp here of where, the presence of God, delineates is his living space. And so I bring that. And my hope is what? Is my hope that I'll be forgiven of a sin? No. Do I want to apologize for something I've done? No. My hope is that I will be accepted, quote, before the Lord. So what does the burnt offering mean? The offerer is seeking fellowship with God. I want to have a little time with God. So I'm coming to his house. I'm bringing a gift, korban, a burnt offering, which is the Hebrew word olah. Again, korban is sort of a generic term for gift. Olah is the specific term for burnt offering. And I'm bringing it because I want God to not kill me. I want God to accept me as a visitor. I want to be safe in his presence. So I'm bringing this gift. Now, you could say, well, that sounds a little bit like a bribe. Well, if that helps you, okay. I mean, I personally wouldn't use that language, but you're trying to, again, visit God just for a little while, and you have to approach him where he lives, and you don't want anything bad to happen. So you want him to accept you. It's a way of initiating a visit. It's a way of initiating a little time of fellowship and communion with God. It's like if you get invited over to somebody's house to eat. My wife is very good at always bringing a little gift. Okay. The icebreaker, the little thing to present to the host, that sort of thing. I mean, we do this in our, the course of our lives in different ways, but we bring a token of friendship, little offering, a little gift. And so the offerer brings his gift before God, the whole burnt offering, because he would like a little bit of God's time. If we read through the rest of the passage, we find out that there's no specific sin that needs to be forgiven. That's not even in the picture. What is in the picture is I'm mortal and I'm imperfect. And I don't think so, but I might be impure in some way. I hope not. But I want to spend a little time with God because I'm grateful for what he's done. And to do that, I need to go to his house, and I hope nothing bad happens. I want him to accept me so that we can have this little time while I watch my offering get burned up, and hopefully God enjoys that. That's the burnt offering. It's a type of the sacrifice itself. You'll often see it translated whole burnt offering. Everything was consumed on the altar except for the hide. So no one, including the priests, and of course the offerer, no one is going to eat any of this. So that's why it's called an offering as opposed to a sacrifice in Levitical language. Again, sacrifice technically in biblical language is when the offerer and the priest and, you know, in theory, God have a meal together. There's something going on like that. The offerer might be included or not, but the priesthood typically is. But in this case, everything goes to God except for the hide. Everything's burned up. So that's why it's the whole burnt offering. It's a signal to God that his worshiper wants to spend a little time with him. Maybe he wants to offer a prayer. Maybe he wants the priest to pray for him. We don't really know. But there's some reason to be there that isn't, oh, I did this horrible thing over here and I need forgiveness. That is not the purpose of the burnt offering. Now, frequently, the burnt offering was the first sacrifice in a ritual that included other sacrifices. And you can see the logic. This is the Kickstarter. This is the signal to God that somebody's at the door and wants to spend a little time with God. Now, other sacrifices might be needed because maybe the offerer does have something that needs to be taken care of. This is the one, again, that initiates the communing event. That's what it's for. So Leviticus 1:4, go back to the text. It says, he, the offerer, shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it shall be accepted for him to, quote, make atonement for him. You said, well, Mike, I thought you just said that he didn't really have any sin that needed to be forgiven. Okay, right away, we're four verses into Leviticus, and we have to talk about atonement language. Again, you're used to me saying things that, again, you don't hear in church, so here's another one. Atonement language in your English translations, especially in Leviticus, but in lots of other places, doesn't mean what you think it means. Okay? It's not necessarily about forgiveness. It has a broad range of semantic possibilities, the Hebrew term that's underneath this one, or that's rendered atonement. So don't think that the offerer has a specific sin to be forgiven, because we're going to keep reading and find out that isn't the point. So he shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering. It shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. Then he will kill the bull before the Lord. And Aaron's sons, the priests, shall bring the blood, throw the blood against the sides of the altar, that is, at the entrance of the tent of meeting. Well, wait a minute. Guess what? The blood isn't applied to the offerer. In the sacrificial system of Leviticus, the blood is never applied to the offerer. Sometimes it gets applied to the priest, but again, this whole notion that we have of sacrifice because we filter it through Jesus, how the blood of Jesus is applied to us to take away our sins, that isn't what's going on in Leviticus. Okay, there's a disconnect there, and so we need to talk about some of the language here. Verse 6, then he shall flay the burnt offering, cut it into pieces, the sons of Aaron will put it in the fire, and arrange the wood, and you know, it goes up in smoke. Around verse 9, it's a pleasant aroma to the Lord. And then from verse 10 on, I'm not going to really worry about that because it's, well, if he doesn't have a bull, then if it's a sheep or goat or a bird or whatever, different kinds of things you could bring for the burnt offering. Okay, I want to stick here to the meaning of the burnt offering. So let's go back to verse 4. He shall lay his hand on the head of the burnt offering. Now that symbolic act, we think typically sort of transfers something to the animal. Again, that is not what they're thinking. This symbolic act served to designate the animal as a sacrificial victim for the specific ritual. In other words, this animal, before being brought to the tent of meeting, was common. It was one of a bunch of animals, but now it's being designated, it's being consecrated for sacred use. Okay, designating this specific animal is now belonging to the Lord. it doesn't mean I'm transferring now through some mystical way my sins onto this animal. Again, that isn't the point. We're going to see something closer to that in other places in Leviticus, but it's not the point right here. So the act should not be interpreted as, again, indicating some sort of transferral of guilt or transferral of impurity to the animal. There's no guilt in view here. The offerer is just bringing a gift to seek access. He's not asking for forgiveness. Now, the next line says, it shall be accepted for him to make atonement for him. And here's where we have to get into atonement language. Now, the context is the olah. Again, if you read through the whole chapter, and it's chapter one is about this one sacrifice, you will not read anywhere in the chapter that there's any need for expiation of sin. Okay, that's one thing. If we look at Exodus 30, verse 12, we get an interesting parallel to this. I'm going to read you that verse. It says, when you take the census of the people of Israel, then each shall give a ransom for his life to the Lord when you number them, that there be no plague among them when you number them. You say, well, how in the world is that a sacrifice, Mike? And let me read it one more time. The Lord says to Moses, when you take the census of the people of Israel, then each shall give a ransom for his life. The word there is kofar. It's the same word back in Leviticus 1:4 for atonement. Okay, there it's the verb, kipper. Kofar, kipper, it's the same consonants. So back to Exodus 30:12. When you take the census of the people, each shall give a ransom, a kofar, for his life to the Lord when you number them, that there be no plague among you when you number them. Well, again, in the context there, it's a census. It's not about cleaning up a lot of sin on a lot of people. So this idea of paying a ransom, okay, when they're counted, when they're enrolled back in Exodus, that's something that I want to focus on. The point of the parallel is that back in Exodus 30:12, there's no expiation for sin going on. Instead, it's protection from God's wrath. To be considered acceptable back in Exodus 30:12, really refers to we have a gift being given. In that case, back in Exodus 30, it was money. It was a half shekel instead of a blood offering. But the payment was given in that passage for an Israelite to be acceptable to occupy sacred space. And the reason is given four verses later in Exodus 30, quote, that they're giving it for the service of the tent of meeting, unquote. So there was need of precious metals. Okay, they're giving shekels here to make, you know, parts of the tabernacle and accoutrements and that sort of thing. So this is, it's a one-time situation. It's not an annual gift. But the idea is that, look, if you're going to participate in this, in building this tabernacle, if you're going to obey God and meet the need for the building implements for this, then for you to be acceptable to work here, to occupy sacred space both now and in the future after this thing is built, you need to bring a half shekel. You need to contribute. If you don't, Exodus 30:12 says, there's going to be a plague among you. In other words, God's going to punish people who are not willingly participating in the construction and the use thereafter of the tabernacle. So the whole idea of the kofar here is protection from the wrath of God. And that is really more what's going on back in Leviticus 1. Again, Leviticus 1, the worshiper says, I want to spend some time with God, so I have to go to his house. And he goes to the door of the tent of meeting, brings the offering. Why? He wants to be accepted. Again, he doesn't want anything bad to happen. He wants to, again, initiate that relationship. And you do that, you signal to God that you're there and that you want some of his time. And if you bring the acceptable sacrifice, you'll get that time. You'll get your need, whatever it is, taken care of. Now, what does it teach people? The burnt offering, the whole burnt offering, didn't teach any Israelites about you committed a sin and here's what to do. What it taught Israelites was that proximity to God was dangerous. I mean, it was a fearful thing. Proximity to God was inherently dangerous for both the worshiper and the priests, frankly. Even if there had been, you know, there's no particular offense committed to that point, if you do something the way you're not supposed to do it and you knock on God's door, you know, the quote unquote, there's going to be hell to pay. I mean, there's going to be a plague like back in Exodus 30. There's something bad is going to happen. So God does it this way, insists on this to teach a very simple lesson. You're not me. You're not fit to occupy the space that I live on unless I accept you, unless I embrace you. Otherwise, what you're doing is really dangerous. Again, it's a way to protect the worshiper from divine wrath. Now, again, back to the whole atonement thing. I want to say a little bit more about this. And if you don't remember it, fine. If you're not taking notes, fine, because we're going to hit this in other passages. But again, when we see atonement in our English translation, we think that there's a sin issue. Again, what I'm saying is in this particular instance, that is not the case. And in many particular instances, that is not the case. Part of the problem is that there are there are half a dozen different Hebrew words with the same consonants, KPR, as the one that occurs in this passage. This is what's known as a homonym problem. Hebrew is like English. Hebrew has words that are spelled exactly the same way, but that mean different things. So sometimes kofer means just a gift. Again, a ransom, something, you know, that I exchange to protect me or work out, again, some sort of arrangement so that I'm safe and something gets done. That's one of four nouns that are spelled the same way in Hebrew, kofer. If you actually look this up in a lexicon, the one that occurs in Leviticus 1:4 is labeled kofer 4. It's the fourth one. So what I'm saying is for those of you who attempt some original language research in your Bible study, you can't assume, and hopefully you have better tools than a Strong's Concordance. I mean, if that's all you've got, you need to move on. You need to move on to something better because you need a resource, a lexicon, that's going to list out the homonyms for you. Because you can't assume that the Hebrew word you're looking at in a primitive tool like Strong's always is the same word where those three consonants occur. In many cases, it's not, right? It just isn't. Hebrew's like English. Again, English has homonyms. So does Hebrew. And this word is one of them. So in some cases, it's just not going to mean what you think it means, and you can be easily misled in your translation. Now, in a basic sense, the verb kipper means to purge. Okay, we're going to hit other passages where the atonement language of your English translation is going to point to one of the verbs. Again, there are six different KPR words in Hebrew. Four of them are nouns, two of them are verbs. Occasionally, we're going to hit a verb that does have something to do with taking care of an offense or a sin. And again, when we hit those, I'll return to this discussion. I'll tell you which one it is, and we'll talk about what the meaning of the passage is. But in many cases, when the verb is used, it means to purge. It comes from an Akkadian word, kupuru, which means to wipe clean. So that's significant because of things that we'll run into in Leviticus and other places in the Old Testament. For instance, the verb is used a lot with respect to the tabernacle and the altar. Again, to purge the tabernacle, to purge the altar. Okay, what I hope you're seeing is that when this atonement language that you are familiar with, if you've ever read through Leviticus or, you know, God forbid, heard a sermon on Leviticus, and you've been told that this refers to cleansing the offerer of sin, be very careful. Look at what the direct object is. And in many cases in the English translations, it will completely obscure it for you. So try to use an interlinear, reverse interlinear, like in Logos is a great idea here. But in many cases, the blood of the offering will be used to purge the tabernacle, purge the sacred space, to purge the altar, to purge this or that vessel. It's never applied to the human, to the human offerer. It's to make sure that sacred space is not rendered impure by a common human being who is not sanctified as a priest to occupy. A lot of the sacrificial system is about preparing sacred space for your visit, or preparing sacred space so that God deems it fit to spend time there. It's really not about what goes on with the offerer's sin. A lot of bad sins that you could commit in the Old Testament, there were no offerings for. You got the death penalty, or at least you were supposed to. There's no real direct evidence in Scripture that a lot of the death penalty offenses were ever carried out, but that was the solution, removal. Okay, other solutions to other sins was remuneration. You stole that guy's cow, you take it back, and you add one. It has nothing to do with a sacrifice. Again, the sacrificial system, somehow we have oriented it to us. And I guess probably because of the way we think about Jesus. But the sacrificial system for an Israelite wasn't about us, wasn't about the offerer so much as protecting the offerer from God, you know, from the divine presence, because that's just, you know, we can't handle that, or purging sacred space of any impurity so that God could meet the priest there or God could meet the offerer there. Again, we've inverted the system in a lot of ways in our thinking. And as we go through the sacrifices, again, you'll see differences that are going to be quite contrary to what you're used to hearing about this, but that are important. So even if you didn't sin, the whole burnt offering at Leviticus 1, even if you don't have a sin on you, as far as you know, you've had a good day, you've had a good week, whatever it is, even if you didn't sin, God has to be approached with caution because you are not him. If you are not doing procedurally what he has asked you to do, what he has commanded you to do, you're going to be in trouble. Okay? It is a fearful thing to be in the presence of God for an Old Testament Israelite. It is not trivialized. It is not something to take lightly. It's dangerous. So you initiate the relationship with a gift. Now, just think about this in terms of application, and we'll wrap up with this. In what I just described, would you want to live under that? I mean, I wouldn't. I mean, if I have to be so conscious of what I'm doing just to go meet with God, even through a priest, that I could get hurt, or it could launch a plague, or, you know, I could wind up dead, or somebody else, it would cost them their life. I mean, that's just crazy. That's frightening. Now think about that, and you think about what the New Testament says about how God can now be approached. How are we supposed to approach God now? Boldly. Okay, Hebrews 4:16. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. In other words, I don't have to go up to the door and meekly knock and say, boy, I hope this gift is good enough or else I could die. You know, we don't have to think of things that way. And you know, think about, again, what the New Testament says. If you're a Jew, think about what a New Testament Jew in the first century, who knows what the sacrificial system was about, even though they didn't have a temple for a while. Now they have, you know, Herod's temple. And so they have some cognizance of what's going on here, about how people talked about Jesus when they're used to this fearful kind of system. And they can read examples in the Torah of people dying when they do things wrong. I mean, you look at another verse, Ephesians 3:12. Paul says, in whom we have boldness and access with confidence through our faith in him, you know, to approach God. That is not how your typical Jew looked at this. And so Jesus comes along and a Jew hears the message of the cross, the message that, hey, this was your Messiah, died for you, you know, forgive your sins and so on and so forth. And now you can approach God individually and boldly. That was news. That was just dramatically different than the way they were thinking about their faith, you know, their religion. Another thought is, we don't have to bring a gift for access to God. Think about that. Again, if you're a Jew, you're thinking, okay, you know, I'm going to this weird new, you know, gathering of these Christ followers. Like what happens, you know, when I get there, you know, do I need to bring a gift? Do I need to bring an offering? What do I need to do, you know, so that God doesn't strike me down? Hey, that is just gone. There was no need to bring a gift for access to God. That gift was already given for you. It was a voluntary offering of Jesus, of the Messiah himself, completely inverts and does away with this whole need to essentially bribe God for access, to make sure God won't do anything bad to me. And it's really unfortunate that a lot of people still think about God this way. A lot of Christians think about God this way. It's just utterly anachronistic to think about God this way. One last thought. If we're in Christ, we don't occupy sacred space, so to speak. We are sacred space. And that actually is the fundamental theological rationale for subduing the flesh and living in a godly way. You are sacred space. For instance, it's Paul's rationale for why you shouldn't, you know, commit fornication. You know, why you shouldn't eat meat, you know, that was, you know, again, taken directly from a ritual. It's okay if it was in the marketplace, but you don't associate yourself with the ritual of the meat at Corinth. Why? Because then you enter into fellowship with devils, and you can't have fellowship with God and fellowship with beings who are less than God and hostile to God. You can't do it because you are sacred space. Know ye not, Paul says, that you are the temple of the living God. Okay, you have the Spirit, the very presence of God that was in the Old Testament, indwelling in you. Now, again, it would be easy for me to launch into a bit of a mini tirade here, about how we do church. Again, how we do church is so focused on us that honestly, for somebody like me who, you know, I try to shut it off, you know, periodically, but there are places I've gone, you know, churches I've gone into that it is so focused on the person, on the felt needs or whatever it is, that it's just kind of sickening because we've lost any sense. I'm not saying we need to go back and treat our churches like the tabernacle and we got to be careful where we walk and all that kind of stuff, okay? Because we are a sacred space. What I'm saying is we have lost any sense of our gathering as being a sacred gathering. It's noisy. It's lots of running around. It's frankly some crazy stuff. I mean, I could tell you stories. You know, it's hard to believe sometimes what happens in church. And we have lost just about all sensibility to anything like this. And again, I'm not suggesting that, hey, the solution to this is, you know, let's go build a tabernacle and act like we're in the Old Testament. That isn't the point. The point is it would be nice to remember that, you know, the way I behave matters because I am sacred space. And when Christians gather together, yeah, Paul said individually we are the temple of the living God, but he also said in Corinthians that you, plural, you collectively are the temple of the living God. What we're doing here should in some way convey some seriousness, some thoughtfulness to the presence of God. How do we behave differently here than any other place? Because if we behave differently here, that helps us at least remember the presence of God. I mean, very simple things like this. I'm grateful when I see it. This is why, again, this is sort of freebie. In my experience, people who have left what we might call evangelicalism and have gone into like Eastern Orthodoxy or even back to Catholicism or something like that, is that they get drawn in by liturgy because what happens in the service means something. It requires thoughtfulness. There's symbology there that takes the mind of the person in the room, in the church, takes their mind and directs it to specific theological imagery or thoughts or ideas, as opposed to a sporting event. Okay? That's just what the appeal is. And trust me, I understand that. But I have had a number of people say that's what did it for them. And even though they might have a disagreement theologically here or there, I wanted a visit to church to be different from any other place. And different in a specific way. So you take this back to Leviticus 1. Again, their problem was a little bit different. It was a little bit, you know, to the way extreme. But you know, as we read through Old Testament ritual, don't wrinkle your nose up at it. Don't be repulsed by it. Yeah, I'm glad we don't have lots of blood in the altar and all that kind of stuff too. But don't be repulsed by it. Look at it the way they're looking at it and think about it the way they're thinking about it. And the lessons that it was designed to reinforce, even if you don't have a sin on you, God should still be approached with caution. This is not a normal place. This is not a normal event. It's something that should be considered sacred as opposed to common, as opposed to profane, which is what profane means, common, ordinary. This shouldn't be ordinary. It shouldn't be like everything else is during the week. It should be different. Even if we accomplish that much in our worship, I think it would be a good thing. And again, I think Leviticus 1 here, the idea of bringing an offering just so you can even start to enjoy or experience the presence of God in some way without getting hurt is really a good lesson.
Mike, I'm curious, how much of pagan rituals stem from here? I mean, is there any connections to offerings to the lower G gods?
Yeah, there were, I mean, when you get into some of the specific terminology. And again, last week, if you remember, we talked about the need in pagan religion to interact with intermediaries. Okay, the main gods, the high gods, were sort of just out of the picture. You know, they could be sacrificed to and venerated, but as far as your day to day, quote unquote, spiritual needs, there was this whole intermediate world that you had to interact with. So there is a sense in all these systems of, you know, go back to the approaches to sacrifice, that we are offering gifts. In other words, there's some cajoling or sort of establishing a relationship that's important. We can't assume, we can't presume, we can't be presumptive about, you know, how we approach sacred space, whether it's an Israelite religion or some other religion, because the gods have picked this place to inhabit. They have decided to settle in this statue or on this ground to do what gods do. And so we can't presume, we can't be flippant about what we do in these areas, lest the gods be angry. So there is this, again, sense of otherness that is reflected in sacrificial systems elsewhere. The whole, again, bringing a gift, treating it as food, you know, that sort of thing. The communion idea is probably, again, a little less in pagan theory, because there it's more barter. It goes into the logic of idolatry. One of the reasons you built an idol and you performed a ritual to open the mouth, you know, to make it alive, what you were thinking is that the deity is now going to come down here and inhabit it and be localized, so that not only has it chosen to be in this place, but now you know it's here and you can, you know, essentially do lots of nice things for it so it does nice things for you. It's more of a barter mentality, as opposed to the Old Testament. Yeah, we have a tabernacle, we have a holy place, and God is at home, you know, that kind of thing. But God can come and go as he wants. God is not isolated to this place. God has specifically said, you're not going to make anything an idol, because A, I'm not going to be beckoned, right? I'm the one choosing to be here or not. You're not going to build this thing and beckon me here, and I just don't respond that way. I can bless you or punish you no matter what is going on here. I'm giving you a means to know that I'm here and to approach me, but the terms of our relationship are laid out in this covenant that I have made with you and only with you. It's not based on, hey, did I like last week's meal better than this week's, or the amount of what you bring? What God wants, again, just like we read in Psalm 50, come to him with thanksgiving, come to him with gratitude, come to him, you know, with a pure heart, you know, the whole circumcision of the heart thing. It's much more internal than, again, sort of a barter mentality, but again, the logic of it, there's going to be overlaps there, and the terminology, you're going to see overlaps too.
Yeah, that's interesting that, you know, they say a pleasing aroma to the Lord. That's a fascinating concept to think.
Right. Well, people would imagine, especially if it's a meal, I mean, you still get it here with the burnt offering, because even though it wasn't technically a sacrifice because there's no meal, the imagination or the imagery was that God is there, because it's his house, God is there, and he's enjoying, you know, the scent of the meat, you know, being burned. You know, he likes it. It's also why incense was used. You know, incense was used so that the place didn't stink of carcasses and, you know, internal organs and poop and all this other stuff. I mean, this is a mess. You know, when you're dealing with animals and animal remains and whatnot, incense was used, again, to make it pleasant, again, for everyone concerned. And again, it was imagined that this is what God wanted too, because it was pleasing to us, you know, as opposed to this offensive odor over here. So there was that, and also because incense wasn't used in other places. So when you got near sacred space, it smelled different. It let you know. It was another sensory way of letting you know that I'm leaving the common and I'm approaching the uncommon, again, the sacred area.
Is there anything to the actual location of the altar, as far as like, you know, they had to kill it on the north side and they had to throw the blood against the sides of the altar. Is there any?
There is a little something to that. What I mean by that is there may be some significance to that in other passages. So my answer at this point would be, you know, we'll wait till we get there. There is something to be said in a few occasions about orientation. Let's just put it that way. But it's not... It doesn't show up in a lot of places.
All right, then. Well, we'll be looking forward to that. Well, all right, Mike. Well, guess what? Unseen Realm officially launches this week.
That's true. September 1, the official date, you know, right on the edges of that. Boy, I'll be glad. Just, you know, I should tell people, look, September 1, inside the building, we're thinking by September 1, all the versions are going to be available. That means for Unseen Realm, it's a hardcover. I don't know if it will be paperback at some point. Right now, it's hardcover only. But the Kindle version, okay, that's actually already orderable, but that's going to be, you know, up and running. The Logos versions, again, September 1 is this date by which all the e-versions and the physical versions that are going to be made have been made.
All right. Well, that's exciting. Look, it's finally here. So
yep.
No stopping it now.
Yep.
Okay.
And go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, we should also, again, we don't do this every week or every episode, but thank our Patreon subscribers. We've, you know, gotten a few more of those. And you know, again, what we're hoping for is that this will grow and allow us to do, you know, some different things. But we're grateful to everyone who has donated a little bit, you know, on a monthly basis to help us out.
Absolutely. We appreciate it. And also, Mike, I wanted to mention, gotten some questions about David Burnett's paper. You could email him at dburnett51@yahoo.com if you're interested in getting David's paper. And Mike, could you give us a little explanation of what his paper pertains to?
Yeah, it's really focusing on the Genesis language, you know, so shall thy seed be. And again, David's argument is that in Second Temple Jewish literature, again, the quote-unquote intertestamental period, there was lots of belief, lots of theological discussion about how that promise was not just quantitative. It wasn't just that the people of God will become numerous, but it was also qualitative. They will become as the stars, okay? So not just as numerous as the stars, but as the stars. In other words, they'll become divine. They will eventually be glorified. They will become divine beings. And we get this in New Testament theology that we will become like the Lord. You know, behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God or the children of God, and you know, we shall be like him, that sort of thing. Well, that language that we see a lot of different places, you know, partaking of the divine nature, as Peter says about believers, that language actually was considered by many Jewish writers in the intertestamental period to be traceable back to the promise about the stars that God gave to Abraham. So that's essentially what David's paper is tracking on, that the development of that whole trajectory of thinking.
And again, if you want that paper, email David at dburnett, burnett51@yahoo.com. All right, Mike, well, next week we're going to be doing the next two chapters of Leviticus.
Right, Leviticus 2 and 3.
Okay, good deal. And with that, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.